Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Last night, Bank of America ponied up $2 billion to keep Countrywide Financial from going under. Today, it's like the credit crunch never happened. Or maybe everybody's just whistling past the graveyard. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 23rd of August. It's a Thursday, and it is good to have you with us. I'll tell you what. I'll lay out the financial news of the past couple of days. You decide whether things are okay or maybe not. In no particular order, we have relative calm in the markets, no bombshells from mortgage lenders today anyway, and the bond market's looking more stable. On the other hand, the Federal Reserve is still pumping money into the financial sector to prevent a crisis. Countrywide CEO Angelo Mozzillo, the man arguably at the center of the storm, says we're headed for a recession. And lots of people are still banking on the Fed to cut rates. I don't know where you came down on whether the worst has passed or not, but we decided to call financial strategist Richard Beauvais at the investment bank Punk Siegel for some guidance. Mr. Beauvais, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
There's been a certain sense the past couple of days of that maybe we're sort of past the worst of whatever this crisis was. Do you think that's true?
No, it's not even remotely close to being true. I think that basically what we learned in the past 3 to 5 days is that holders of funds got frightened because they didn't know what they owned and because they were losing money on certain portions of these investments. The Fed stepped in and is trying to take us over that period of stress. However, it still doesn't solve the problem that somebody has to come up with the money to make the payments on these different forms of debt which are outstanding in the economy.
Cast your mind forward now with me to the 18th of September when the Federal Open Market Committee talks about interest rates. What happens if they don't cut the federal funds rate on that date?
The real issue is that we need economic growth, and economic growth is going to stimulate income growth, which is going to solve the problem. On September 18th, I think the Fed is going to reduce the discount rate by another 50 basis points.
That is to say, they'll cut the discount rate, the rate they cut last Friday, by another 0.5%.
Correct. And they won't touch the federal funds rate. Now, the reason why I'm saying that is because we had a very odd development in the market yesterday. The Federal Reserve requested that the four largest banks in the United States borrow $500 million apiece at the discount window. The reason why that was somewhat bizarre is because none of these banks needed that money. Why would the Fed do that? The stated reason is because the Fed wants to create confidence among other banks that they should also borrow from the Federal Reserve discount window.
That all goes back, though, to the reason we called you up to begin with, which is the idea that what's happening as these very public moves are made is, in some sense, a confidence game in the most pejorative sense of the word.
Yes, you're right. In other words, basically, the money is there. It exists. The problem is that the holders of funds have lost confidence in the system and therefore do not want to lend it. And what the Fed is attempting to do is break the logjam to allow people to use their money to put it back in the system. Once it's achieved that result, then it has to start working, if it can, and I don't think it can, on the real problem, which is how do you get enough income in the economy to actually meet the debt service payments?
And we just don't know yet, right?
No, we don't. We don't know that.
Richard Beauvais is a financial strategist at Punk Siegel. Mr. Beauvais, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Countrywide shares rose about 1% today for keeping track. Otherwise, sort of a muted day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today, crews in Utah are working on what will be the last try at reaching miners trapped for more than 2 weeks now. In Washington, Senator Edward Kennedy promised hearings into mine safety when Congress reconvenes after Labor Day. But the Bush administration is already preparing new rules to encourage what some say is a safer and more efficient type of above-ground mining. It's called mountaintop or strip mining. The proposal isn't officially out yet. It's set to be released tomorrow. But our Washington bureau chief John Dimsdale reports environmentalists are already worried.
To mine coal from the surface, you have to shear off mountaintops, and that creates a lot of rock and rubble that fill up valleys and streams. Under 1983 rules, streams can't be disturbed unless the mining company proves no harm will come to wildlife or water quality. But the language is vague enough that courts have struggled with challenges for decades, says Robert Lee, a coal industry specialist with the energy consultant CRA International.
A technical reading of the legal material can lead to a number of highly divergent interpretations. So, you know, I think these kind of clarifications are necessary.
After 6 years of study, the Interior Department is about to reveal its clarifications. Environmentalists are expecting looser restrictions on mountaintop mining for several reasons. For one thing, coal has become more critical to the nation's fuel supply, given the price of oil. Plus, there's the Bush administration's cozy relations with the coal industry. And now there's added pressure since surface mining avoids the dangers of underground cave-ins and floods. But Joe Lovett with the Appalachian Center for the Economy and the Environment argues other consequences have to be considered.
There is no question that deep mining is far less damaging to the environment than surface mining is, especially the kind of surface mining we're seeing in central Appalachia that's laying waste to hundreds of thousands of the most productive and diverse temperate hardwood forests in the world.
There's a 60-day comment period for the proposed changes. A final rule isn't expected until next year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Those who've been on an airplane this summer know the feeling of dread that comes with a trip to the airport. Overcrowded planes and flight delays have become the norm, not the exception. The Federal Aviation Administration is about to do something that might ultimately help that latter problem. The government plans to award a contract to overhaul the nation's air traffic control system by the end of the month. The list of bidders includes companies you'd probably expect, like defense contractor Lockheed Martin and the engineering company ITT. But Marketplace's Lisa Napoli reports there's a not-so-usual suspect on the list, too.
The satellite radio company XM figures into one of the bids, the one made by defense contractor Raytheon. Now, what could the purveyor of superstar country hits of the 80s have to do with improving air traffic control? Technology analyst Jimmy Scheffler says he knows.
The XM ingredient involves using XM satellites to track weather fronts, which they've been doing for a long, long time.
Providing weather data to the cockpit is just one piece of the complex air traffic control system upgrade. Going from the antiquated analog system to a digital one will speed up communications in the skies and route traffic more quickly. That'll supposedly help accommodate flight volume that's going to swell. The number of people flying is expected to double by the year 2025. And Paul Takamoto of the FAA says because of that, the $20 billion upgrade is essential. He says test programs have also shown it's safer.
With satellites, the signal is much more precise, it's much more accurate, and that allows us to safely reduce the separation standards.
That's aviation speak for how close airplanes can fly. The closer they can fly, the more planes there can be in the skies to relieve some of the gridlock. No matter who gets the contract from the government sometime in the next week, don't expect any immediate relief. All this upgrading is going to be gradual. It'll take 20 years. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
The first three rules of real estate are pretty well known, I'd wager. It's that old joke about location. But what if the most desirable location happens to hold Asia's biggest slum? The Indian government wants to turn that country's financial capital, Mumbai, into a world-class city. Step one, remake that slum into luxury apartments and offices. Step two, figure out what to do with the people who live there. Miranda Kennedy has the story.
At first glance, the slum, Dharavi, looks like anything but hot real estate. Its 500 acres of ramshackle shanties are teeming with millions of residents. Electrical wires dangle between the huts. But Ashish Kalra sees the place differently. He points out the industrial park and commuter trains nearby.
Mumbai is probably one of the world's most expensive real estate. Commercially, it has a great advantage.
Kalra is head of a New York-based investment firm called Tricona Capital. He says Mumbai is to India what Manhattan is to the U.S. for real estate. And like Manhattan, Mumbai is an island, so there's nowhere to go but up. But to do that, Kalra had to relocate some of the city's 7 million slum dwellers.
So when you take existing stock and you provide lower-income housing, unlike the rest of the world where in Paris, you know, there were ghettos built outside or in New York, you have to build it within the same radius.
Hamid bhai se milna hai office. This is it.
Kalra's invested $1 billion in upscale projects like this sleek, modern apartment building. He knocked down a two-story shanty and replaced it with a tower of exclusive units. The apartments here are million-dollar homes with sweeping city views, marble floors, and 24-hour gated security. The demand for these expensive apartments is so great that they sold out before the building was even finished. But to make room for these gleaming buildings, they first had to raise the slums and then build a modest cement block-style housing complex for the former slum residents. It's one of over 100,000 low-cost complexes recently built in Mumbai. It can boast concrete floors, elevators, and running water. In the slums of Dharavi, women wash clothes against slabs of concrete in streams of open sewage. 15-year-old Shagufta Khan is perched on the rickety staircase leading up to her family's one-room shack. It's like a precariously balanced treehouse. Shagufta says she's heard about the plan to rebuild the shanties here.
It will be a much better place to live in because right now it really is not exactly a great place to live in. So I feel that it will be nice if everyone gets a house in a tower or a well-maintained place.
But not everyone in Dharavi agrees. Some residents are resisting the plan to take up the vertical life in apartment towers. They prefer their sprawling horizontal spaces where families cook together and work and chat and wander between compounds. In Mumbai, I'm Miranda Kennedy for Marketplace.
Coming up, driving up the stakes in the race for rental car customers.
You know, they're going to give us a run for the money. This is good for consumers because they have choices. But we'd love to compete.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ended pretty much where it started at 13,235. The NASDAQ fell 0.4%, 11 points, closed at 2,541. The S&P 500 ended the day down 0.1%, or 1.5 points, at 1,462. Home Depot dropped 0.2% on news that the sale of its supply unit might not go ahead as planned. Union Pacific, the country's largest railroad firm, fell 0.2% on news of falling freight traffic. We mentioned Countrywide Financial up 0.9% on news that B of A is going to buy a stake in the lender. B of A shares, that's Bank of America by the by, rose 0.3%. Bonds traded up. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 4.63%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, also sponsoring PBS's CEO Exchange, shrm.org. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders and new home sales for July. New rules regulating good manufacturing practices for dietary supplements go into effect. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration aims to ensure vitamins contain what is on the label. And the U.S. Court of Military Commission review, the nation's new terrorism appeals court, hears its first case. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Centers for Disease Control says almost two-thirds of us are carrying around more weight than we should. It's a pretty safe bet. Most of us are keen to lose those pounds. But losing's the easy part. Keeping the weight off is more difficult, which has, in part, led to the increasing popularity of weight loss surgery. Helen Palmer reports now from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH. A couple of studies out today seem likely to push even more people to think about going under the knife.
Today's New England Journal of Medicine compares death rates for people who had weight loss surgery with a matched group who didn't.
Those in the surgery group decreased death rate from any cause by about 40%.
Lead author Ted Adams of the University of Utah says cancer death rates in people who had the surgery dropped 60%. Diabetes deaths fell more than 90%, so it's plain that there are health benefits to the surgery. But that doesn't mean more people should have the operation. Internist George Bray wrote an accompanying editorial. Think of the cost, he says.
The healthcare system has a great many demands on it. Where does this cost fit in that priority scheme?
Currently, people only qualify for the surgery if they're severely overweight or have an accompanying illness like diabetes. Then public programs like Medicare will pay, but not all private insurance will pick up the tab. Philip Schauer, head of weight loss surgery at the Cleveland Clinic, says they should pay. He says the surgery is cost-effective because obese people run up big medical bills.
They're constantly seeing the doctor. They're sicker. They're less productive. So you add up all those costs, and the cost of surgery can generally be paid for itself in a matter of 3 to 5 years.
Some disagree. Marion Nessel lectures at New York University's Department of Nutrition. She says surgery is an extreme and dangerous way of controlling calorie intake.
And it's being looked at as the panacea to the weight loss problem. I think it's not.
In October, the National Institutes of Health will meet to consider revising the guidelines for weight loss surgery. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
The chain of healthcare professionals is a long one, from the doctors who do those weight loss surgeries to anesthetists and nurses and pharmacists. There's a growing shortage of people trained to make sure we get the right medicines in our prescription bottles. Colleges in Tennessee have stepped up to fill the gap, but Blake Farmer reports that's fueling worries about another shortage.
Richie Lynn wears the classic white smock to work every day in this family-owned drugstore. A Good Neighbor Pharmacy logo is embroidered on his breast pocket. Lynn fills the prescription for one of his regulars.
Is it time for all the rest of them? You need all of them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I need the Plavix, too.
Lynn does just about everything here. He counts the pills, answers the phone, and files the paperwork. He's been working in this shop all his life. He's in his late 50s now, but he gets unsolicited job offers every week.
It's a recruiter calling to see if there's anybody here to offer me a job.
Recruiters are after Lynn because in hospitals and retail stores around the country, there aren't enough pharmacists to go around. Bettina Black is director of the Tennessee Pharmacist Association. She says the nationwide shortage can be traced back to the 1980s when the industry's accreditation body clamped down on enrollment.
That was based on a projection in the past that we weren't going to need as many pharmacists, so we shouldn't over-educate pharmacists.
Jack Bovender wonders if that accreditation body was on something when it made those projections. He's chairman of Nashville-based hospital operator HCA. Bovender points to more recent surveys that say the industry will need 160,000 new pharmacists over the next 10 years.
As this baby boom generation is aging and will need more health care, the majority of the professions in health care are themselves filled by baby boomers who will be retiring.
Universities all around the country are opening or expanding pharmacy schools to train new druggists. But it's in Tennessee that colleges are really falling all over themselves to meet the increased demand. HCA is partnering with Belmont University in Nashville to open a pharmacy school by next fall. Lipscomb University, just 2 miles down the road from Belmont, unveiled its plans for a pharmacy school late last year. Just west of Nashville, faculty members at Union University approved plans for a pharmacy school there in May. Bettina Black says Tennessee will go from 1 to 5 schools of pharmacy in a matter of 3 years.
If you're going to ask me about, are we going to need all of the students that could potentially be trained in these colleges, I think that question is yet to be answered.
Black worries that as more schools open, standards could fall. But she says a more immediate problem is finding people to teach all those prospective pharmacists.
If you go in and you talk to the people who accredit colleges of pharmacy, they'll tell you that just as acute as the shortage of pharmacists is the shortage of pharmacy faculty.
To make up the shortfall, schools are poaching from the industry and from other colleges.
There is a shortage nationwide of over 400 faculty positions.
That's Roger Davis, the new dean of pharmacy at Lipscomb. He says the pool of teachers is small, and like many working pharmacists, they're not getting any younger.
A lot of the faculty existing colleges of pharmacy are within retirement age.
Pharmacy schools around the country are facing the same challenge, how to inject new blood into an industry that's expected to grow sharply in the coming years. Tennessee colleges, in particular, are making big bets on projections of an acute need for pharmacists. They hope the forecasts are real, or else the healthcare sector is in for an overdose, courtesy of eager Tennessee schools. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Earlier this month, just about the time Cerberus, the private equity group, was closing its deal to buy Chrysler, it was closing another car deal, too, selling its Alamo and National Rental Car brands to the number one company in the industry. Enterprise Rent-A-Car has been around for 50 years, a privately held company the entire time. For decades, it was where Alamo and National weren't, in neighborhoods, not airports, catering to customers whose cars were in the shop. It was a low-margin business that would have been a tough sell with Wall Street shareholders. But Enterprise is changing. Today, on Conversations from the Corner Office, the guy in the driver's seat.
The boss will see you now.
Enterprise Chief Andy Taylor's the son of the company's founder. He's only the second CEO Enterprise has ever had. We met recently in St. Louis to talk about what's next for the company as it puts the Alamo National purchase in the rearview mirror.
We have committed for about 18 months to running two companies with three brands. And our goal is, and I've told employees, both the Alamo National employees and Enterprise, our intention is to grow all three brands.
But if you go out to the airport, as we came in this morning, you know, you could go to Enterprise and get a car for however many dollars it is. Then you go next door to Alamo, and it's $20 more than that. And then you go next door to National, and it's $20 more than that. Are you, in a sense, at least for the next 18 months, competing against yourself?
It's amazing. The three companies, the customers that they serve, don't overlap much at all. Now, yes, if you're at the airport, got off a plane and didn't have a reservation, you could walk down there. In a sense, we are competing with each other. Yeah.
But I get the sense you're not too worried about that.
No. In fact, I think the better story is that I was with a bunch of our rental managers the other day, and I was speaking to one of them who is at an Enterprise brand, Florida Airport, right next door to the National brand. Customer came up to Enterprise and said, I really need a Suburban. I got a bunch of people and a bunch of golf clubs, and we didn't. Walked right to the National counter, said, do you have a Suburban and can you help this customer? He's a mutual customer of ours.
All right, so let me ask you one more thing about the airport. You ready? So we're waiting out there this morning. It's 95 degrees. We were waiting at the Enterprise sign, and the National Alamo van drove right past us.
You know, we made this acquisition.
Yeah,
we
right.
made this acquisition 15 days ago.
I'm just pulling
out. Oh no! I take our business very seriously, and that is a great point. Thank you.
I'm just thinking. You know,
give me some more of those little pearls,
right,
okay?
That's right. Keeping it on airports for a minute, you have been, as you said, getting into the airport market more now with the Enterprise brand in the last 5-6 years. You're going to do so even more intensively now with the National and Alamo. Still, though, you're going up against Hertz and Avis, which have a huge part of that very important market. How are you going to do?
Well, we have great respect for Hertz and Avis, and you know, they're going to give us a run for the money. This is good for consumers because they have choices. but we'd love to compete.
You have to explain to me how the biggest rental car company in North America getting bigger is good for consumers. You going to be cheaper now for us?
Well, first of all, I think we're going to compete very well for value-minded customers because we have by far the strongest balance sheet in the industry. Our interest costs, for example, are hundreds of millions of dollars lower than some of our competitors. We are the value leader. We are not going to be a company that is going to, at one point, be flipped, be levered up, have higher costs, and have to raise rates.
Enterprise is one of, if not the biggest purchaser of automobiles on the whole planet. With that comes a certain obligation to sustainability and global warming. How do you see that obligation?
Well, first of all, the debate about global warming is over, as far as my family and our business is concerned. And yes, we have a lot of cars. We're going to need a lot of cars. We're going to need fuel. But we're also, at the same time, have to be very cognizant of what the public thinks of an entity like us. We are doing things right now that, for, let me just give you a couple of examples. We have over 40,000 flex fuel vehicles that can utilize E85, which is the ethanol, 85% ethanol. There's not a lot of refueling stations yet, but we're putting those vehicles at our offices that are near where E85 is vended. Then we've got over 3,000 hybrids. We've tweaked our fleet, so roughly a third of them get over 32 miles to the gallon. We have nearly 40% of our fleet gets over 28 miles per gallon. And long story short, we can't reinvent car manufacturing and the fueling systems, but when those technologies present themselves, we're going to be there using them, buying them, and introducing that to our customers.
Andy Taylor is the chairman and CEO of Enterprise Rent-A-Car. Andy, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
There's more of my interview with Andy Taylor on our website. You can find conversations from other corner offices there as well. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes, Sun Microsystems is hoping a small change will add a little pep to its stock value. The company that came up with the Java programming language will be changing its ticker symbol to JAVA. At the moment, it's the very uninspired SUNW. It's worth a mention here that Sun's share price is off almost 10% this year. And to get back to where we started today, that is, whether the credit crunch, the Federal Reserve announced this afternoon that the dollar amount banks borrowed from the discount window, remember that's the interest rate the Fed just cut, the dollar amount that banks borrowed there spiked to more than six times normal this past week. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow ended at about where it started, which would be 13,235. The NASDAQ dropped 11 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 fell 1.5 points. That's 0.1% there. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, banks provide a new solution to an old scam.
The payday lenders would come and get in line and try to cash that post-dated check before the member could come and get money for groceries or whatever.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.